table. A pang of nausea that I'm unable to stifle washes warmly over me. But since I'm really dreaming all this, I'm able to ask, "So you say there's no non-smoking section? Is this correct?" "Yes, sir," the maitre d', younger than myself, faggy, innocent, an actor, no doubt, adds, "I'm sorry." Well, this is very interesting. I can accept this. I reach into my back pocket for my gazelle skin wallet and press a 20 into the maitre d's uncertain fist. He looks at the bill, confused, then murmurs, "Thank you," and walks away as if in a daze. "No, thank you," I call out and take my seat across from Bethany, nodding courteously to the couple next to us, and though I try to ignore her for as long as etiquette allows, I can't. Bethany looks absolutely stunning, just like a model. Everything's murky, I'm on edge. Feverish, romantic notions. "Didn't you smoke at Harvard?" is the first thing she says. "Cigars," I say, "only cigars." "Oh," she says. "But I quit that." I lie, breathing in hard, squeezing my hands together. "That's good," she nods. "Listen, did you have any trouble getting reservations?" I ask, and I am fucking shaking. I put my hands on the table like a fool, hoping that under her watchful gaze they will stop trembling. "You don't need reservations here, Patrick," she says soothingly, reaching out a hand, covering one of mine with hers. "Calm down. You look like a wild man."
I'm calm,
I say, breathing in hard, trying to smile, and then, involuntarily, unable to stop myself, ask, "How's my hair?"
"Your hair is fine," she says. "Shh, it's okay."
"All right. I am all right." I try to smile again, but I'm sure it looks just like a grimace. After a short pause, she comments,
"That's a nice suit. Henry Stewart?"
"No," I say, insulted, touching its lapel. "Garrick Anderson."
"It's very nice," she says, and then genuinely concerned. "Are you okay, Patrick? You just twitched."
"Listen, I'm frazzled. I just got back from Washington. I took the Trump shuttle this morning," I tell her, unable to make eye contact, all in a rush. "It was delightful. The service, really fabulous. I need a drink." She smiles, amused, studying me in a shrewd way.
"Was it?"
she asks. Not totally, I sense, without smugness. "Yes." I can't really look at her, and it takes immense effort to unfold the napkin, lay it across my lap, reposition it correctly. Busy myself with the wine glass, praying for a waiter, the ensuing silence causing the loudest possible sound.
"So, did you watch the Patty Winters show this morning?"
"No, I was out jogging," she says, leaning in. "It was about Michael J. Fox, right?"
"No," I correct her. "It was about Patrick Swayze."
"Oh, really?"
she asks, then,
"It's hard to keep track. You're sure?"
"Yes, Patrick Swayze. I'm positive."
"How was it?"
"Well, it was very interesting," I tell her, breathing in air. "It was almost like a debate about whether he's gotten cynical or not."
"Do you think he has?" she asks, still smiling.
"Well, no, I'm not sure," I start nervously. "It's an interesting question. It wasn't explored fully enough. I mean, after Dirty Dancing, I wouldn't think so, but with Tiger Warsaw, I don't know. I might be crazy, but I thought I detected some bitterness. I'm not sure." She stares at me, her expression unchanged. "Oh, I almost forgot," I say, reaching into my pocket. "I wrote you a poem." I hand her the slip of paper. "Here." I feel sick and broken, tortured, really on the brink.
"Oh, Patrick," she smiles. "How sweet."
"Well, you know," I say, looking down shyly. Bethany takes the slip of paper and unfolds it.
"Read it,"
I urge enthusiastically. She looks it over quizzically, puzzled, squinting,
Then she turns the page over to see if there's anything on the back. Something in her understands it's short, and she looks back at the words written, scrawled in red on the front of the page.
"It's like haiku, you know?"
I say. "Read it. Go on." She clears her throat and hesitantly begins reading, slowly, stopping often. "The poor nigger on the wall. Look at him." She pauses and squints again at the paper, then hesitantly resumes. "Look at the poor nigger. Look at the poor nigger on the wall." She stops again, faltering, looks at me, confused, then back at the paper.
"Go on," I say, looking around for a waiter. "Finish it."
She clears her throat and, staring steadily at the paper, tries to read the rest of it in a voice below a whisper.
"Fuck him. Fuck the nigger on the wall."
She falters again, then reads the last sentence, sighing.
"Black man is da Bill?"
The couple at the next table have slowly turned to gaze over at us. The man looks aghast. The woman has an equally horrified expression on her face. I stare her down, glaring, until she looks back at her fucking salad.
"Well, Patrick," Bethany says, clearing her throat, trying to smile, handing the paper back to me.
"Yes?" I ask.
"Well?" "I can see that..."
She stops, thinking.
"That your sense of social injustice is..."
She clears her throat again and looks down.
"Still intact."
I take the paper back from her and slip it in my pocket and smile, still trying to keep a straight face, holding my body upright so she won't suspect me of cringing. Our waiter comes over to the table, and I ask him what kinds of beer they serve.
"Heineken, Budweiser, Amstel Light," he recites.
"Yes?" I ask, staring at Bethany, gesturing for him to continue.
"That's, all, sir," he says.
"No Corona, no Kirin, no Grolsch, no Moretti?" I ask, confused, irate.
"I'm sorry, sir, but no," he says cautiously. "Only Heineken, Budweiser, Amstel Light."
"That's crazy," I sigh. "I'll have a J&B on the rocks. No, an absolute martini. No, a J&B straight up."
"And I'll have another San Pellegrino," Bethany says.
"I'll have the same thing," I quickly add, my leg jerking up, then down uncontrollably beneath the table.
"Okay.
Would you like to hear the specials?" he asks.
"By all means,"
I spit out, then, calming down, smile reassuringly at Bethany.
"You're sure?"
he laughs. "Please," I say, unamused, studying the menu. "For appetizers, I have the sun-dried tomatoes and golden caviar with poblano chilies, and I also have a fresh endive soup. Wait a minute. I say, holding up a hand, stopping him. "Hold on a minute."
"Yes, sir?"
the waiter asks, confused.
"You have?"
"You mean the restaurant has," I correct him.
"You don't have any sun-dried tomatoes. The restaurant does.
You don't have any poblano chilies. The restaurant does. Just, you know, clarify." The waiter, stunned, looks at Bethany, who handles the situation deftly by asking him,
"So how is the endive soup served?"
Cold, the waiter says, not fully recovered from my outburst, sensing he's dealing with someone very, very on edge. He stops again, uncertain. "Go on," I urge. "Please, go on."
"It's served cold," he starts again. "And for entrees, we have monkfish with mango slices and red snapper sandwich on brioche with maple syrup and,"
he checks his pad again,
"cotton."
"Mmm. Sounds delicious. Cotton. Mmm," I say, rubbing my hands together eagerly. "Bethany?" I'll have the ceviche with leeks and sorrel, Bethany says, and the endive with walnut dressing.
Sir? The waiter asks tentatively.
I'll have...
I stop, scan the menu quickly.
I'll have the squid with pine nuts and... Can I have a slice of goat cheese, of shaver?
I glance over at Bethany to see if she flinches at my mispronunciation.
With that and some... Oh, some salsa on the side.
The waiter nods, leaves. We're left alone.
Well,
she smiles, then notices the table slightly shaking.
What's wrong with your leg?
My leg?
Oh.
I look down at it, then back at her.
It's the music. I like the music a lot. The music that's playing.
What is it?
She asks, tilting her head.
Trying to catch a refrain of the New Age Muzak coming from the speakers hooked to the ceiling over the bar.
I think it's Belinda Carlisle, I guess. I'm not sure.
But...
She starts, then stops.
Oh, forget it.
But what?
But I don't hear any singing.
She smiles, looks down demurely. I hold my leg still and pretend to listen.
But it's one of her songs, I say, then lamely add. I think it's called Heaven is a Place on Earth.
You know it.
Listen,
she says.
Have you gone to any concerts lately?
No, I say, wishing she hadn't brought this, of all topics, up. I don't like live music.
Live music?
She asks, intrigued, sipping San Pellegrino water.
Yeah, you know, like a band,
I explain, sensing from her expression that I'm saying totally the wrong things.
Oh, I forgot. I did see you too.
How were they?
She asks.
I liked the new CD a lot.
They were great. Just totally great. Just totally...
I pause, unsure of what to say. Bethany raises her eyebrows quizzically, wanting to know more.
Just totally... Irish.
I've heard they're quite good live,
she says, and her own voice has a light musical lilt to it.
Who else do you like?
Oh, you know, I say, completely stuck. The Kingsmen, Louie, that sort of stuff.
Gosh, Patrick,
she says, looking at every part of my face.
What?
I panic, immediately touching my hair. Too much mousse? You don't like the Kingsmen?
No,
she laughs.
I just don't remember you being so tan back at school.
I had a tan then, didn't I?
I ask.
I mean, I wasn't Casper the Ghost or anything, was I?
I put my elbow on the table and flex my biceps, asking her to squeeze the muscle. After she touches it reluctantly, I resume my questions.
Was I really not that tan at Harvard?
I ask, mock worriedly, but worriedly.
No, she laughs. You were definitely the George Hamilton of the class of 84.
Thanks, I say, pleased. The waiter brings our drinks. 2 bottles of San Pellegrino water. Scene 2.
So you're at Mill...
On the water...
Taffeta, what is it?
I ask, her body, her skin tone seem firm and rosy.
Millbank Tweed, she says. That's where I am.
Well, I say, squeezing a lime into my glass, that's just wonderful. Law school really paid off.
And you're at P&P? She asks.
Yes, I say. She nods, pauses, wants to say something, debates whether she should, then asks, all in a matter of seconds.
But doesn't your family own...
I don't want to talk about this, I say, cutting her off. But yes, Bethany, yes.
And you still work at P&P?
She asks. Each syllable is spaced so that it bursts, booming sonically into my head.
Yes, I say, looking furtively around the room.
But She's confused. Didn't your father...
Yes, of course, I say, interrupting. Have you had the focaccia at Poon Cakes, Patrick?
Yes.
What's wrong?
I just don't want to talk about... I stop. About work.
Why not?
Because I hate it, I say. Now listen, have you tried the Poon Cakes yet? I think Miller underrated it.
Patrick, she says slowly, if you're so uptight about work, why don't you just quit?
You don't have to work. Because, I say, staring directly at her, I want to fit in. After a long pause, she smiles.
I see.
There's another pause. This one I break. Just look at it as, well, a new approach to business, I say.
How, she stalls, sensible.
She stalls again. How, practical. Lunch is alternately a burden, a puzzle that needs to be solved, an obstacle, and then it floats effortlessly into the realm of relief, and I'm able to give a skillful performance. My overriding intelligence tunes in and lets me know that it can sense how much she wants me, but I hold back, uncommitted. She's also holding back, but flirting nonetheless. She has made a promise by asking me to lunch, and I panic. Once the squid is served, certain that I will never recover unless it's fulfilled. Other men notice her as they pass by our table. Sometimes I coolly bring my voice down to a whisper. I'm hearing things, noise, mysterious sounds inside my head. Her mouth opens, closes, swallows liquid, smiles, takes me in like a magnet covered with lipstick. Mentioned something involving fax machines twice. I finally order a J&B on the rocks, then a cognac. She has mint coconut sorbet. I touch, hold her hand across the table, more than a friend. Sun pours into vanities. The restaurant empties out. It nears three. She orders a glass of Chardonnay, then another, then the check. She has relaxed, but something happens. My heartbeat rises and falls, momentarily stabilizes. I listen carefully. Possibilities once imagined plummet. She lowers her eyes, and when she looks back at me, I lower mine.
So, she asks, are you seeing anyone?
My life is essentially uncomplicated, I say thoughtfully, caught off guard.
What does that mean? She asks.
I take a sip of cognac and smile secretly to myself, teasing her, dashing her hopes, her dreams of being reunited.
Are you seeing anyone, Patrick? She asks. Come on, tell me.
Thinking of Evelyn, I murmur to myself, yes.
Who?
I hear her ask.
A very large bottle of Desirel,
I say in a faraway voice, suddenly very sad.
What?
She asks, smiling, but then she realizes something and shakes her head.
I shouldn't be drinking.
No, I'm not, really, I say, snapping out of it, then not of my own accord. I mean, does anyone really see anyone? Does anyone really see anyone else? Did you ever see me? See? What does that mean? Ha! See? Ha! I just don't get it. Ha! I laugh. After taking this in, she says, nodding,
that has a certain kind of tangled logic to it, I suppose.
Another long pause, and I fearfully ask the next question. Well, are you seeing anyone? She smiles, pleased with herself, and still looking down, admits, with incomparable clarity.
Well, yes, I have a boyfriend, and...
Who?
What?
She looks up.
Who is he?
What's his name?
Robert Hall. Why?
With Solomon Brothers?
No, he's a chef.
With Solomon Brothers?
Patrick, he's a chef. And co-owner of a restaurant.
Which one?
Does it matter?
No, really. Which one? I ask, then under my breath. I want to cross it out of my Zagat guide.
It's called Dorsia, she says, then. Patrick, are you okay?
Yes, my brain does explode, and my stomach bursts open inwardly. A spastic, acidic, gastric reaction. Stars and planets, whole galaxies made up entirely of little white chef hats, race over the film of my vision. I choke out another question. Why Robert Hall? I ask. Why him?
Well, I don't know, she says, sounding a little tipsy. I guess it has to do with being 27 and...
Yeah? So am I. So is half of Manhattan. So what? That's no excuse to marry Robert Hall.
Marry? She asks, wide-eyed, defensive. Did I say that?
Didn't you say marry?
No, I didn't, but who knows? She shrugs. We might.
Terrific.
As I was saying, Patrick,
she glares at me, but in a playful way that makes me sick,
I think you know that, well, time is running out. That biological clock just won't stop ticking, she says, and I'm thinking, my God, it took only 2 glasses of Chardonnay to get her to admit this. Christ, what a lightweight. I want to have children.
With Robert Hall? I ask, incredulous. You might as well do it with Captain Lou Albano, for Christ's sakes. I just don't get you, Bethany. She touches her napkin, looking down and then out onto the sidewalk, where waiters are setting up tables for dinner. I watch them, too.
Why do I sense hostility on your part, Patrick? She asks softly, then sips her wine.
Maybe because I'm hostile, I spit out. Maybe because you sense this.
Jesus, Patrick, she says, searching my face, genuinely upset. I thought you and Robert were friends.
What? I ask. I'm confused.
Weren't you and Robert friends?
I pause, doubtful.
Were we? Yes, Patrick, you were.
Robert Hall, Robert Hall, Robert Hall, I mutter to myself, trying to remember. Scholarship student? President of our senior class? I think about it a second longer, then add,
weak chin? No, Patrick, she says, the other Robert Hall.
I'm confusing him with the other Robert Hall, I ask.
Yes, Patrick, she says, exasperated.
Inwardly cringing, I close my eyes and sigh.
Robert Hall.
Not the one whose parents own half of, like, Washington. Not the one who was, I gulp, captain of the crew team. 6 feet.
Yes, she says, that Robert Hall.
But, I stop.
Yes, but what?
She seems prepared to wait for an answer. But he was a fag, I blurt out.
No, he was not, Patrick, she says, clearly offended.
I'm positive he was a fag. I start nodding my head.
Why are you so positive? She asks, not amused.
Because he used to let frat guys, not the ones in my house, like, you know, gang bang him at parties and tie him up and stuff. At least, you know, that's what I've heard. I say sincerely, and then more humiliated than I have ever been in my entire life, I confess. Listen, Bethany, he offered me a, you know, a blowjob once in the, civic section of the library.
Oh my God, she gasps, disgusted. Where's the check?
Didn't Robert Hall get kicked out for doing his thesis on Babar? Or something like Babar, I ask. Babar, the elephant? The, oh, Jesus, French elephant?
What are you talking about?
Listen to me, I say. Didn't he go to business school at Kellogg? At Northwestern, right?
He dropped out, she says without looking at me.
Listen, I touch her hand. She flinches and pulls back. I try to smile. Robert Hall's not a fag.
I can assure you of that, she says a tad too smugly.
How can anyone get indignant over Robert Hall? Instead of saying, Oh, yeah, you dumb sorry bitch, I say soothingly. I'm sure you can. Then, tell me about him. I want to know how things stand with the two of you. And then, smiling, furious, full of rage, I apologize. I'm sorry. It takes some time, but she finally relents and smiles back at me, and I ask her once again, tell me more. And then, under my breath, smiling a rictus at her, I'd like to slice open your beaver. The Chardonnay has mellowed her, so she softens and talks freely. I think about other things while she describes her recent past. Air, water, sky, time, a moment. A point somewhere when I wanted to show her everything beautiful in the world. I have no patience for revelations, for new beginnings, for events that take place beyond the realm of my immediate vision. A young girl, a freshman, I met in a bar in Cambridge my junior year at Harvard, told me early one fall that life is full of endless possibilities. I tried valiantly not to choke on the beer nuts I was chewing while she gushed this kidney stone of wisdom, and I calmly washed them down with the rest of a Heineken, smiled and concentrated on the dart game that was going on in the corner. Needless to say, she did not live to see her sophomore year. That winter, her body was found, floating in the Charles River, decapitated. Her head hung from a tree on the bank, her hair knotted around a low-hanging branch 3 miles away. My rages at Harvard were less violent than the ones now, and it's useless to hope that my disgust will vanish. There is just no way. Oh, Patrick, she's saying, you're still the same. I don't know if that's good or bad. Say it's good. Why? Is it? She asks, frowning. Was it? Then? You only knew one facet of my personality, I say. Student. Lover? She asks, her voice reminding me of someone human. My eyes fall on her coldly, untouched. Out on the street, music that sounds like salsa blares. The waiter finally brings the check. I'll pay for it, I sigh. No, she says, opening her handbag. I invited you. But I have a platinum American Express card, I tell her. But so do I, she says, smiling. I pause, then watch her place the card on the tray the check came on. Violent convulsions seem close at hand if I do not get up. The women's movement, wow, I smile, unimpressed. Outside she waits on the sidewalk, while I'm in the men's room throwing up my lunch, spitting out the squid, undigested and less purple than it was on my plate. When I come out of vanities onto the street, putting on my wayfarers, chewing a cert, I murmur something to myself, and then I kiss her on the cheek and make up something else. Sorry it took so long. Had to call my lawyer. Oh? She acts concerned. The dumb bitch. Just a friend of mine, I shrug. Bobby Chambers. He's in prison. Some friends of his, well, mainly me, are trying to remount his defense. I say with another shrug, then changing the subject. Listen. Yes? She asks, smiling. It's late. I don't want to go back to the office, I say, checking my Rolex. The sun setting glints off it, momentarily blinding her. Why don't you come up to my place? What? She laughs. Why don't you come up to my place? I suggest again. Patrick, she laughs suggestively. Are you serious? I have a bottle of Puy Fuissé, chilled. Huh? I say, arching my eyebrows. Listen, that line might have worked at Harvard, but... She laughs, then continues. We're older now, and... She stops. And? What? I ask. I shouldn't have had that wine at lunch, she says again. We start walking. It's 100 degrees outside, impossible to breathe. It's not day, it's not night. The sky seems yellow. I hand a beggar on the corner of Duane and Greenwich $1 just to impress her. Listen, come over, I say again, almost whining. Come on over. I can't, she says. The air conditioning in my office is broken, but I can't. I'd like to, but I can't.
Oh, come on, I say, grabbing her shoulders, giving them a good-natured squeeze.
Patrick, I have to be back at the office, she groans, protesting weakly.
But you'll be sweltering in there, I point out.
I have no choice.
Come on. Then, trying to entice her, I have a 1940s Durgan Gorham four-piece sterling silver tea and coffee set I'd like to show you.
I can't, she laughs, putting on her sunglasses.
Bethany, I say, warning her.
Listen, she says, relenting, I'll buy you a Dove Bar. Have a Dove Bar instead.
I'm appalled. Do you know how many grams of fat, of sodium, are in the chocolate covering alone? I gasp, mock horrified.
Come on, she says. You don't need to worry about that.
No, you come on, I say, walking in front of her for a little while so she won't sense any aggressiveness on my part. Listen, come by for a drink, and then we'll walk over to Dorsia and I'll meet Robert, okay? I turn around, still walking, but backward now. Please.
Patrick, she says, you're begging.
I really want to show you that Durgan Gorham tea set. I pause.
Please.
I pause again. It cost me $3,500. She stops walking because I stop, looks down, and when she looks back up, her brow, both cheeks, are damp with a layer of perspiration, a fine sheen. She's hot. She sighs, smiling to herself. She looks at her watch.
Well? I ask. If I did, she starts.
Yes? I ask, stretching the word out.
If I did, I have to make a phone call.
No, negative, I say, waving down a cab. Call from my place.
Patrick, she protests. There's a phone right over there.
Let's go now, I say. There's a taxi. In the cab heading toward the Upper West Side, she says,
I shouldn't have had that wine.
Are you drunk?
No,
she says, fanning herself with a playbill from Les Miserables someone left in the back seat of the cab, which isn't air-conditioned, and even with both windows open, she keeps fanning herself.
Just slightly tipsy.
We both laugh for no reason, and she leans into me, then realizes something and pulls back.
You have a doorman, right? She asks, suspiciously.
Yes. I smile, turned on by her unawareness of just how close to peril she really is. Inside my apartment. She moves into the living room area, nodding her head approvingly, murmuring,
Very nice, Mr. Bateman, very nice.
Meanwhile, I'm locking the door, making sure it's bolted shut. Then I move over to the bar and pour some J&B into a glass while she runs her hand over the Wurlitzer jukebox, inspecting it. I've started growling to myself, and my hands are shaking so badly I decide to forego any ice, and then I'm in the living room, standing behind her while she looks up at the David Onica that's hung above the fireplace. She cocks her head, studying it. Then she starts giggling and looks at me, puzzled. Then back at the Annika, still laughing. I don't ask what's wrong. I could care less. Downing the drink in a single gulp, I move over to the Anaholian white oak armoire, where I keep a brand new nail gun I bought last week at a hardware store near my office in Wall Street. After I've slipped on a pair of black leather gloves, I make sure the nail gun is loaded.
Patrick, Bethany asks, still giggling.
Yes, I say, then...
Darling. Who hung the Annika? She asks.
You like it? I ask.
It's fine, but...
She stops, then says,
I'm pretty sure it's hung upside down.
What?
Who hung the Annika?
I did, I say, my back still to her.
You've hung the Annika upside down.
She laughs.
Hmm.
I'm standing at the armoire, squeezing the nail gun, getting used to its weight in my gloved fist.
I can't believe it's upside down, she says. How long has it been this way?
A millennium, I whisper, turning around, nearing her.
What?
She asks, still studying the Annika.
I said, what in the fuck are you doing with Robert Hall?
I whisper.
What did you say?
As if in slow motion, like in a movie, she turns around. I wait until she's seen the nail gun and the gloved hands to scream, what the fuck are you doing with Robert Hall? Perhaps on instinct, perhaps from memory, she makes a futile dash for the front door, crying out. Though the Chardonnay has dulled her reflexes, the scotch I've drunk has sharpened mine, and effortlessly I'm leaping in front of her, blocking her escape, knocking her unconscious with four blows to the head from the nail gun. I drag her back into the living room, laying her across the floor, over a white voile couture cotton sheet, and then I stretch her arms out, placing her hands flat on thick wooden boards, palms up, and nail three fingers on each hand at random to the wood by their tips. This causes her to regain consciousness, and she starts screaming. After I've sprayed mace into her eyes, mouth, into her nostrils, I place a camel hair coat from Ralph Lauren over her head, which drowns out the screams, sort of. I keep shooting nails into her hands until they're both covered, nails bunched together, twisted over each other in places, making it impossible for her to try and sit up. I have to remove her shoes, which slightly disappoints me, but she's kicking at the floor violently, leaving black scuff marks on the stained white oak. During this period, I keep shouting, "You bitch!" at her, and then my voice drops to a raspy whisper, and into her ear I drool the line, "You fucking cunt!" Finally, in agony, after I've taken the coat off her face, she starts pleading, or at least tries to, the adrenaline momentarily overpowering the pain.
"Patrick, oh God, stop it! Please, oh God, stop hurting me!"
But typically, the pain returns. It's too intense not to, and she passes out again and vomits while unconscious, and I have to hold her head up so she doesn't choke on it, and then I mace her again. The fingers I haven't nailed I try to bite off, almost succeeding on her left thumb, which I manage to chew all the flesh off of, leaving the bone exposed, and then I mace her needlessly once more. I place the camel hair coat back over her head in case she wakes up screaming, then set up the Sony palm-sized handycam so I can film all of what follows. Once it's placed on its stand and running on automatic, with a pair of scissors, I start to cut off her dress. And when I get up to her chest, I occasionally stab at her breasts, accidentally, not really, slicing off one of her nipples through the bra. She starts screaming again once I've ripped her dress off, leaving Bethany in only her bra, its right cup darkened with blood, and her panties, which are soaked with urine, saving them for later. I lean in above her and shout over her screams. Try to scream, scream, keep screaming. I've opened all the windows and the door to my terrace, and when I stand over her, the mouth opens and not even screams come out anymore. Just horrible, guttural, animal-like noises, sometimes interrupted by retching sounds. Scream, honey, I urge, keep screaming. I lean down even closer, brushing her hair back. No one cares. No one will help you. She tries to cry out again, but she's losing consciousness, and she's capable of only a weak moan. I take advantage of her helpless state, and, removing my gloves, force her mouth open, and with the scissors, cut out her tongue, which I pull easily from her mouth and hold in the palm of my hand, warm and still bleeding, seeming so much smaller than in her mouth, and I throw it against the wall, where it sticks for a moment, leaving a stain, before falling to the floor with a tiny wet slap. Blood gushes out of her mouth, and I have to hold her head up so she won't choke. Then I fuck her in the mouth, and after I've ejaculated and pulled out, I mace her some more. Later, when she briefly regains consciousness, I put on a pork pie hat I was given by one of my girlfriend's freshman year at Harvard. "Remember this?" I shout, towering over her. "And look at this," I scream triumphantly, holding up a cigar. "I still smoke cigars." Ha! See? A cigar.
I light it with steady, blood-stained fingers, and see her face, pale to the point of blueness, keeps contracting, twitching with pain, her eyes dull with horror, closed then open halfway, her life reduced to nightmare. "And another thing," I yell, pacing. "It's not Garrick Anderson, either. The suit is by Armani, Giorgio Armani." I pause spitefully and leaning into her sneer. "And you thought it was Henry Stewart. Jesus." I slap her hard across the face and hiss the words, "Dumb bitch," spraying her face with spit. But it's covered with so much mace that she probably can't even feel it. So I mace her again, and then I try to fuck her in the mouth once more, but I can't come, so I stop. Thursday. Later, the next night, in fact, three of us, Craig McDermott, Courtney, and myself, are in a cab heading toward Nell's and talking about Evian water. Courtney, in an Armani mink, has just admitted, giggling, that she uses Evian for ice cubes, which sparks a conversation about the differences in bottled water, and at Courtney's request, we each try to list as many brands as we can. Courtney starts, counting each name off on one of her fingers. "Well, there's Sparkal, Perrier, San Pellegrino, Poland Spring, Calistoga." She stops, stuck, and looks over at McDermott for help. He sighs, then lists, "Canadian Spring, Canadian Calm, Montclair, which is also from Canada, Vittel from France, Crodo, which is Italian." He stops and rubs his chin thoughtfully, thinking of one more, then announces it as if surprised. "Elan." And though it seems he's on the verge of naming another one, Craig lapses into an unilluminating silence. "Elan?" Courtney asks. "It's from Switzerland," he says. "Oh," she says, then turns to me. "It's your turn, Patrick." Staring out the window of the cab, lost in thought, the silence I'm causing filling me with a nameless dread, numbly by rote I list the following. "You forgot Alpenwasser, Down Under, Shat, which is from Lebanon, Cubol, and Cold Springs." "I said that one already," Courtney cuts in accusingly. "No," I say, "you said Poland Spring." "Is that right?" Courtney murmurs, then tugging at McDermott's overcoat. "Is he right, Craig?" "Probably," McDermott shrugs. "I guess." "You must also remember that one should always buy mineral water in glass bottles. You shouldn't buy it in plastic ones," I say ominously, then wait for one of them to ask me why. "Why?" Courtney's voice is tinged with actual interest. "Because it oxidizes," I explain. "You want it to be crisp, with no aftertaste." After a long, confused, Courtney-like pause, McDermott admits, staring out the window, "He's right." "I really don't understand the differences in water," Courtney murmurs. She's sitting between McDermott and myself in the back of the cab, and under the mink has on a wool twill suit by Givenchy, tights by Calvin Klein, and shoes by Warren Susan Allen Edmonds. Earlier in this same cab, when I touched the mink suggestively, with no intent other than to check its quality, and she could sense this, Courtney quietly asked me if I had a breath mint. I said nothing. "What do you mean?" McDermott inquires solemnly. "Well," she says, "I mean, what's really the difference between something like spring water and natural water, for instance? Or, I mean, is there one?" "Courtney, natural water is any water from an underground source," Craig sighs, still staring out the window. "Mineral content hasn't been changed, although the water may have been disinfected or filtered." McDermott is wearing a wool tuxedo with notched lapels by Gianni Versace, and he reeks of Xerius. I momentarily break out of my conscious inertia to explain further, "And in spring water, minerals may have been added or removed, and it's usually filtered, not processed." I pause. 75% of all bottled water in America is actually spring water. I pause again, then ask the cab, "Did anyone know that?" A long, soulless pause follows, and then Courtney asks another question, this one only half-finished. "The differences between distilled and purified water is..." I'm not really listening to any of this conversation, not even to myself, because I'm thinking of ways to get rid of Bethany's body, or at least debating whether or not I should keep it in my apartment another day or so. If I decide to get rid of it tonight, I can easily stuff what's left of her into a hefty garbage bag and leave it in the stairwell, or I can exert the extra effort and drag it into the street, leaving it with the rest of the trash on the curb. I could even take it to the apartment in Hell's Kitchen and pour lime over it, smoke a cigar, and watch it dissolve while listening to my Walkman, but I want to keep the men's bodies separate from the women's. And besides, I also want to watch Blood Hungry, the videotape I rented this afternoon. Its ad line reads, "Some clowns make you laugh, but Bobo will make you die, and then he'll eat your body." And a midnight trip to Hell's Kitchen, even without a stop at Bellevue's for a small bite to eat, wouldn't give me enough time. Bethany's bones and most of her intestines and flesh will probably get dumped into the incinerator down the hall from my apartment. Courtney McDermott and I have just left a Morgan Stanley party that took place near the seaport at the tip of Manhattan in a new club called Gold Card, which seemed like a vast city of its own, and where I ran into Walter Rhodes, a total Canadian, whom I haven't seen since Exeter, and who also, like McDermott, reeked of Xerius, and I actually told him, "Listen, I'm trying to stay away from people. I'm avoiding even speaking to them." And then I asked to be excused. Only slightly stunned, Walter said, "Sure, I understand. I'm wearing a 6-button double-breasted wool crepe tuxedo, with pleated trousers and a silk grosgrain bow tie, all by Valentino. Louis Carruthers is in Atlanta for the week. I did a line of coke with Herbert Gitts at Gold Card, and before McDermott hailed this cab to head for Nell's, I took a Halcyon to get rid of the edge from the cocaine, but it hasn't sunk in yet. Courtney seems attracted to McDermott, and since her ChemBank card wasn't functioning tonight, at least not at the automated teller we stopped at, the reason being she uses it too often to cut lines of coke with, though she would never admit this. Cocaine residue has, at various times, fucked up my card also. And McDermott's was working. She bypassed mine in favor of his, which means knowing Courtney that she wants to fuck McDermott. But it doesn't really matter. Even though I'm more handsome than Craig, we both look pretty much the same. Talking animals were the topic of this morning's Patty Winters show. An octopus was floating in a makeshift aquarium with a microphone attached to one of its tentacles, and it kept asking, or so its trainer, who is positive that mollusks have vocal cords, assured us, for cheese. I watched, vaguely transfixed, until I started to sob. A beggar dressed as a Hawaiian frets over a garbage can on the darkened corner of 8th and 10th. "With distilled or purified water," McDermott is saying, "most of the minerals have been removed. The water has been boiled and the steam condensed into purified water. Whereas distilled water has a flat taste and it's usually not for drinking," I find myself yawning. "And mineral water?" Courtney asks. "It's not defined by the..." McDermott and I start simultaneously. "Go ahead," I say, yawning again, causing Courtney to yawn also. "No, you go ahead," he says apathetically. "It's not defined by the FDA," I tell her. "It has no chemicals or salts or sugars or caffeine." "And sparkling water gets its fizz from carbon dioxide, right?" she asks. "Yes," both McDermott and I nod, staring straight ahead. "I knew that," she says, hesitantly, and by the tone of her voice I can sense, without looking over, that she probably smiles when she says this. "But only by naturally sparkling water," I caution, "because that means the carbon dioxide content is in the water at its source. Club soda and seltzer, for example, are artificially carbonated," McDermott explains. "White Rock seltzer is an exception," I mention, nonplussed by McDermott's ridiculous, incessant one-upmanship. "Ramlosa sparkling mineral water is also very good." The cab is about to turn onto 14th Street, but maybe 4 or 5 limousines are trying to make the same right, so we miss the light. I curse the driver, but an old Motown song from the 60s, maybe it's the Supremes, plays muted up front, the sound blocked by the fiberglass partition. I try to open it, but it's locked and won't slide across. Courtney asks, "What kind should you drink after exercising?" "Well," I sigh, Whatever it is, it should be really cold.
Because? She asks.
Because it's absorbed faster than if it was at room temperature. Absently, I check my Rolex. It should probably be water. Evian, but not in plastic.
My trainer says Gatorade's okay,
McDermott counters. But don't you think water is the best fluid replacer since it enters the bloodstream faster than any other liquid? I can't help but add, buddy. I check my watch again. If I have one J&B on the rocks at Nell's, I can make it home in time to watch all of Blood Hungry by 2. Again, it's silent in the cab, which moves steadily toward the crowd outside the club. The limousines dropping off passengers, then moving on. Each of us concentrating on that, and also on the sky above the city, which is heavy, looming with dark clouds. The limousines keep blaring their horns at each other, solving nothing. My throat, because of the coke I did with Gitz, feels parched and I swallow, trying to wet it. Posters for a sale at Crabtree and Evelyn line the boarded windows of abandoned tenement buildings on the other side of this street. Spell mogul, Bateman. How do you spell mogul? M-O-G-U-L. Mogul. Mog-ul. Ice. Ghosts. Aliens.
I don't like Evian, McDermott says somewhat sadly. It's too sweet.
He looks so miserable when he admits this that it moves me to agree. Glancing over at him in the darkness of the cab, realizing he's probably going to end up in bed with Courtney tonight, I feel an instantaneous moment of pity for him. Yes, McDermott, I say slowly. Evian is too sweet. Earlier there was so much of Bethany's blood pooled on the floor that I could make out my reflection in it while I reached for one of my cordless phones, and I watched myself make a haircut appointment at Gio's. Courtney breaks my trance by admitting,
I was afraid to try Pellegrino for the first time.
She looks over at me nervously, expecting me to, what, agree? Then at McDermott, who offers her a wan, tight smile.
But once I did, it was fine.
How courageous, I murmur, yawning again, the cab inching its way toward Nell's, then raising my voice. Listen, does anyone know of a device you can hook up to your phone to simulate that call waiting sound? Back at my place, I stand over Bethany's body, sipping a drink contemplatively, studying its condition. Both eyelids are open halfway, and her lower teeth look as if they're jutting out, since her lips have been torn, actually bitten off. Earlier in the day, I had sawed off her left arm, which is what finally killed her, and right now I pick it up, holding it by the bone that protrudes from where her hand used to be. I have no idea where it is now. The freezer? The closet? Clenching it in my fist like a pipe, flesh and muscle still clinging to it, though a lot of it has been hacked or gnawed off, and I bring it down on her head. It takes very few blows, 5 or 6 at most, to smash her jaw open completely, and only 2 more for her face to cave in on itself. Whitney Houston. Whitney Houston burst onto the music scene in 1985, with her self-titled LP, which had 4 number one hit singles on it, including The Greatest Love of All, You Give Good Love, and Saving All My Love for You. Plus, it won a Grammy Award for Best Pop Vocal Performance by a Female and 2 American Music Awards, one for Best Rhythm and Blues Single and another for Best Rhythm and Blues Video. She was also cited as Best New Artist of the Year by Billboard and by Rolling Stone magazine. With all this hype, one might expect the album to be an anticlimactic, lackluster affair, but the surprise is that Whitney Houston, Arista, is one of the warmest, most complex, and altogether satisfying rhythm and blues records of the decade, and Whitney herself has a voice that defies belief. From the elegant, beautiful photo of her on the cover of the album, in a gown by Giovanni Damara, and its fairly sexy counterpart on the back, in a bathing suit by Norma Kamali, one knows that this isn't going to be a blandly professional affair. The record is smooth, but intense, and Whitney's voice leaps across so many boundaries and is so versatile, though she's mainly a jazz singer, that it's hard to take in the album on a first listening. But you won't want to. You'll want to savor it over many.
It opens with "You Give Good Love" and "Thinking About You," both produced and arranged by Kashif, and they emanate warm, lush jazz arrangements, but with a contemporary synthesized beat. And though they're both really good songs, the album doesn't get kicking until "Someone for Me," which was produced by Jermaine Jackson, where Whitney sings longingly against a jazz disco background, and the difference between her longing and the sprightliness of the song is very moving. The ballad, "Saving All My Love for You," is the sexiest, most romantic song on the record. It also has a killer saxophone by Tom Scott, and one can hear the influence of 60s girl group pop in it. It was co-written by Jerry Goffin. But the 60s girl groups were never this emotional, or sexy, or as well produced, as this song is. "Nobody Loves Me Like You Do" is a glorious duet with Jermaine Jackson, who also produced it, and just one example of how sophisticated lyrically this album is. The last thing it suffers from is a paucity of decent lyrics, which is what usually happens when a singer doesn't write her own material, and has to have her producer choose it. But Whitney and company have picked well here. The dance single, "How Will I Know," my vote for best dance song of the 1980s, is a joyous ode to a girl's nervousness about whether another guy is interested in her. It's got a great keyboard riff, and it's the only track on the album, produced by Wunderkind producer Narada Michael Walden. My own personal favorite ballad, aside from "The Greatest Love of All," her crowning achievement, is "All at Once," which is about how a young woman realizes, all at once, her lover is fading away from her, and it's accompanied by a gorgeous string arrangement. Even though nothing on the album sounds like filler, the only track that might come close is "Take Good Care of My Heart," another duet with Jermaine Jackson. The problem is that it strays from the album's jazz roots and seems too influenced by 1980s dance music. But Whitney's talent is restored with the overwhelming "The Greatest Love of All," one of the best, most powerful songs ever written about self-preservation and dignity. From the first line, Michael Masser and Linda Creed are credited as the writers, to the last, it's a state-of-the-art ballad about believing in yourself. It's a powerful statement, and one that Whitney sings with a grandeur that approaches the sublime. Its universal message crosses all boundaries and instills one with the hope that it's not too late for us to better ourselves, to act kinder. Since it's impossible in the world we live in to empathize with others, we can always empathize with ourselves. It's an important message, crucial really, and it's beautifully stated on this album. Her second effort, Whitney, Arista 1987, had 4 number one singles. "I Wanna Dance With Somebody," "So Emotional," "Didn't We Almost Have It All," and "Where Do Broken Hearts Go," and was mostly produced by Narada Michael Walden. And though it's not as serious an effort as Whitney Houston, it's hardly a victim of sophomore slump. It starts off with the bouncy, danceable "I Wanna Dance With Somebody Who Loves Me," which is in the same vein as the last album's irrepressible "How Will I Know." This is followed by the sensuous "Just the Lonely Talking Again," and it reflects the serious jazz influence that permeated the first album, and one can also sense a newfound artistic maturity in Whitney's voice. She did all the vocal arrangements on this album, and this is all very evident on "Love Will Save the Day," which is the most ambitious song Whitney's yet performed. It was produced by Jellybean Benitez, and it pulsates with an up-tempo intensity, and like most of the songs on this album, it reflects a grown-up's awareness of the world we all live in. She sings, and we believe it. This is quite a change from the softer, little-girl-lost image that was so appealing on the first album. She projects an even more adult image on the Michael Masser-produced "Didn't We Almost Have It All," a song about meeting up with a long-lost lover and letting him know your feelings about the past affair, and it's Whitney at her most poetic. And as on most of the ballads, there's a gorgeous string arrangement. "So Emotional" is in the same vein as "How Will I Know" and "I Wanna Dance With Somebody," but it's even more rock-influenced, and like all the songs on Whitney, played by a terrific backup studio band, with Narada on drum machine, Walter Afanasieff on the synthesizer and synth bass, Corrado Rustici on synth guitar, and someone listed as Bongo Bob on percussion programming and drum sampling. "Where You Are" is the only song on the album produced by Kashif, and it bears his indelible imprint of professionalism. It has a smooth, gleaming sound and sheen to it, with a funky sax solo by Vincent Henry. It sounded like a hit single to me, but then all the songs on the album do, and I wondered why it wasn't released as one. Love is a Contact Sport is the album's real surprise. A big-sounding, bold, sexy number that, in terms of production, is the album's centerpiece. And it has great lyrics along with a good beat. It's one of my favorites. On You're Still My Man, you can hear how clearly Whitney's voice is like an instrument, a flawless, warm machine that almost overpowers the sentiment of her music. But the lyrics and the melodies are too distinctive, too strong to let any singer, even one of Whitney's caliber, overshadow them. For the Love of You shows off Narada's brilliant drum programming capabilities, and its jazzy modern feel harks back not only to purveyors of modern jazz like Michael Jackson and Sade, but also to other artists like Miles Davis, Paul Butterfield, and Bobby McFerrin. Where Do Broken Hearts Go is the album's most powerful emotional statement of innocence lost and trying to regain the safety of childhood. Her voice is as lovely and controlled as it ever has been, and it leads up to I Know Him So Well, the most moving moment on the record, because it's first and foremost a duet with her mother, Sissy. It's a ballad about who? A lover shared, a long-lost father, with a combination of longing, regret, determination, and beauty that ends the album on a graceful, perfect note. We can expect new things from Whitney. She made a stunning gift to the 1988 Olympics with the ballad One Moment in Time. But even if we didn't, she would remain the most exciting and original black jazz voice of her generation. Dinner with Secretary. Monday night at 8 o'clock, I'm in my office attempting yesterday's New York Times Sunday crossword puzzle, listening to rap music on the stereo, trying to fathom its popularity. Since a little blonde hardbody I met at O-Bar 2 nights ago told me that rap is all she listens to, and though later I beat the living shit out of her at someone's apartment in the Dakota, she was almost decapitated, hardly a strange experience for me. Earlier this morning, her taste in music haunted my memory, and I had to stop at Tower Records on the Upper West Side and buy $90 worth of rap CDs. But, as expected, I'm at a loss. Niggerish voices uttering ugly words like digit, pudding, chunk. Jean sits at her desk, which is piled high with reams of documents that I want her to go over. Today has not been bad. I worked out for 2 hours before the office. The new Robeson Hirsch restaurant called Finna opened in Chelsea. Evelyn left 2 messages on my answering machine and another with Jean, letting me know that she'll be in Boston for most of the week. And best of all, the Patty Winters show this morning was in 2 parts. The first was an exclusive interview with Donald Trump. The second was a report on women who've been tortured. I'm supposed to have dinner with Madison Gray and David Campion at Café Luxembourg, but at 8:15 I find out that Lewis Carruthers is going to be dining with us, so I call up Campion, the dumb bastard, and cancel, then spend minutes debating about what I should do with the rest of the evening. Looking out my window, I realize that within moments the sky above this city will be completely dark. Jean peers into my office, knocking gently on the half-open door. I pretend not to acknowledge her presence, though I'm not sure why, since I'm kind of lonely. She moves up to the desk. I'm still staring at the crossword puzzle with my wayfarers on, stunned, but for no real reason. She places a file on top of the desk before asking, "Doing the crossword?" Dropping the G in doing, a pathetic gesture of intimacy, an irritating stab at forced friendliness. I gag inwardly, then nod without looking up at her. "Need help?" she asks, moving cautiously around the desk to where I sit, and she leans over my shoulder to offer assistance. I've already filled in every space with either the word meat or bone, and she emits only a slight gasp when noticing this, and when she sees the pile of number 2 pencils I've snapped in half lying on my desk, she dutifully picks them up and walks out of the room. "Jean," I call.
"Yes, Patrick."
She re-enters the office, trying to downplay her eagerness. Would you like to accompany me to dinner? I ask, still staring at the crossword, gingerly erasing the M in one of the many meats I've filled the puzzle with. That is, if you're not doing anything.
Oh, no,
she answers too quickly, and then, I think realizing this quickness, says,
I have no plans.
Well, isn't this a coincidence? I ask, looking up, lowering my wayfarers. She laughs lightly, but there's a real urgency in it, something uncomfortable, and this does little in the way of making me feel less sick.
I guess,
she shrugs. I also have tickets to a Milla Vanilla concert, if you'd like to go, I tell her casually. Confused, she asks,
Really? Who?
Milla Vanilla, I repeat slowly.
Milla Vanilla?
She asks uncomfortably. Milla Vanilla, I say. I think that's what their name is. She says,
I'm not sure.
About going?
No, of the name.
She concentrates, then says,
I think they're called Milli Vanilli.
I pause for a long time before saying,
Oh.
She stands there, nods once. It doesn't matter, I say. I don't have any tickets to it anyway. It's months from now.
Oh,
she says, nodding again.
Okay.
Listen, where should we go? I lean back and pull my Zagat from the desk's top drawer. She pauses, afraid of what to say, taking my question as a test she needs to pass, and then, unsure she's chosen the right answer, offers,
Anywhere you want?
No, 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 I smile, leafing through the booklet. How about anywhere you want?
Oh, Patrick, she sighs, I can't make this decision.
No, come on, I urge, anywhere you want.
Oh, I can't.
Helplessly, she sighs again.
I don't know.
Come on, I urge her. Where do you want to go? Anywhere you want, just say it. I can get us in anywhere. She thinks about it for a long time and then, sensing her time is running out, timidly asks, trying to impress me,
What about Dorcia?
I stop looking through the Zagat guide, and without glancing up, smiling tightly, stomach dropping, I silently ask myself, Do I really want to say no? Do I really want to say I can't possibly get us in? Is that what I'm really prepared to do? Is that what I really want to do? So, I say, placing the book down, then nervously opening it up again to find the number. Dorcia is where Jean wants to go.
Oh, I don't know, she says, confused. No, we'll go anywhere you want.
Dorcia is fine, I say casually, picking up the phone, and with a trembling finger very quickly dial the 7 dreaded numbers, trying to remain cool. Instead of the busy signal I'm expecting, the phone actually rings at Dorcia, and after 2 rings, the same harassed voice I've grown accustomed to for the past 3 months answers, shouting, Dorcia, yes? The room behind the voice a deafening hum. Yes, can you take 2 tonight? Oh, let's say in around 20 minutes? I ask, checking my Rolex, offering Jean a wink. She seems impressed. We are totally booked, the maitre d' shouts out smugly. Oh, really? I say, trying to look pleased, on the verge of vomiting. That's great. I said we're totally booked, he shouts. 2 at 9? I say, perfect. There are no tables available tonight, the maitre d' unflappable drones. The waiting list is also totally booked. He hangs up. See you then. I hang up too, and with a smile that tries its best to express pleasure at her choice, I find myself fighting for breath, every muscle tensed sharply. Jean is wearing a wool jersey and flannel dress by Calvin Klein. an alligator belt with a silver buckle by Barry Keiselstein Cord, silver earrings and clear stockings, also by Calvin Klein. She stands there in front of the desk, confused.
Yes? I ask, walking over to the coat rack. You're dressed... okay.
She pauses.
You didn't give them a name, she says softly.
I think about this while putting on my Armani jacket, and while re-knotting my Armani silk tie, and without stammering, I tell her, they know me. While the maitre d' seats a couple who I'm pretty sure are Kate Spencer and Jason Lauder, Jean and I move up to his podium, where the reservation book lies open, names absurdly legible,